Three, two, one. Justin Wren, ladies and gentlemen. Come on. Hello, fella. With the silky hair and the beautiful beard.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure, my brother. How's things?
Man, things are good. Things are really good. I mean, last night getting to go to the Comedy Store for the first time and seeing all those legends and just being in a legendary atmosphere. I mean, it was seriously an incredible time.
It's a fun place, right?
Yeah. I mean, and you had us rolling. So it was really fun. I got to see Brendan and Brian Callen first and then you. And so it was just hilarious.
Did you get to go to the upstairs room as well? Or did you go to the two
was
downstairs
Was that where you
rooms?
Were?
No, I was in the belly room is upstairs.
Okay.
Brendan and Brian were in the main room.
I was
and
there.
I was in the original room, which
and
is
was
the
in
front
the original.
Room. Yeah.
Yeah. So I didn't get to go to the top.
Tonight I'll show you the top.
Okay.
It's a bizarre little place. There's three comedy clubs in one place.
Yeah. It was awesome.
Yeah. It's fucking great.
Yeah. Walking around, seeing all the history, seeing everyone get amped, and then being able to be that close to the comedians too is pretty awesome. I mean, being able to meet them, say hi, and just you're in arm's distance from them. So really unique. If anyone hasn't gone, I suggest going because it was awesome.
Yeah, I think Chappelle has filmed his Netflix special, his next one. He did there.
In the belly room.
In the belly room, yeah. I watched him work one of them out. I don't think he was filming then, but I'm not sure.
Comes out soon, right?
Does it?
I think they weirdly announced that it comes out this month, I think.
Whoa.
I'll double check on that real quick, but I think so.
That might be the case because it's so small. There's probably not a lot of camera angles. And I know he filmed a lot of shows. So maybe he just wants to just get one of them perfect and then throw it out there. But he had a lot of like really topical material, real current material.
Yeah. Was it smaller than the room that you were in last
night?
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, wow.
Not even half the size.
Wow.
Yeah.
See, that's incredible.
December 31st? Yeah. That's crazy.
They don't have a video here, but this is Equanimity is what it's called.
Nice. It was funny, man. It was really funny. And then seeing him in that tiny little room, like there were 70 people in the room.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. They did get more in there sometimes, but don't tell the fire department. Because they fucking shouldn't. Speaking of fire department.
Oh, man.
It's crazy out here.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah. I mean, I seen that video you posted on your Instagram.
Yeah.
It seriously looks like Armageddon.
Yeah, it's from Barstool Sports. If anybody wants to go to their Instagram page, somebody put up a video of last night driving up the 405.
Gosh.
It's the craziest thing you ever see.
It's like, the entire mountain.
What's crazy is that's Bel Air. I mean, that's like a really ritzy area. Super expensive houses. And that fire is just raging towards them. It's right near the Getty Center. And what they're calling this is a dry hurricane.
Wow. So I don't live in California and I'm not a homeowner yet, but does homeowner insurance cover all that or do you have to have extra like fire insurance?
That's a very good question and I don't know the answer.
Yeah, because my family was in Hurricane Katrina and because they had hurricane insurance, but they didn't have like wind insurance. And so
what?
The insurance companies
Wait
would say,
the fuck yeah, a minute.
Or flooding insurance or something like that. It was
what?
Whatever you didn't have, you would get one and not the other. And so then whatever you didn't have, that's what the insurance company would claim. Well, you didn't have this and that's what you should have had.
Oh,
and
my
so
God.
People were losing tons of money, their whole homes. My family lost a whole roof off their house.
Ah, these monsters.
Yeah. And so that's what I'm wondering. Like, okay, you have homeowner insurance, but do you have fire insurance? And are they going to cover that? You know, if that's Bel Air and that's million-dollar homes, hopefully they have the right insurance.
Well, I'm sure some people have fire insurance. I know it's a thing. Just like hurricane and flood insurance is also a thing, but
do they have fire hurricane?
It's a good
insurance?
Question. Well, yeah, right. This is a fire hurricane. It's not just a hurricane. Well, they're calling it a dry hurricane, meaning there's no
hurricane.
Wind or there's no water, but it's hurricane gale force winds. Gale
wow.
force? I don't know if that's right. Hurricane force winds. Technically, not like you know.
In my hotel,
Katrina,
the wind was just ripping all last night, and I know that there's those fires out there. Man, that's crazy.
Yeah, it's insane, man. Where I live, I was evacuated twice.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, twice in the early 2000s, where the fire got so close, it was within a mile of my house, and you know, when it hits and the wind goes. It can take over, like it can just run. They said that the fires that they were having in Northern California were going through an entire football field every 6 seconds.
Oh my gosh. That's mind blowing.
Fuck, man. Just
wow.
Imagine watching that, watching fires just cut through a football field 100 yards every 6 seconds.
Yeah, it's almost like those clouds when the storm's rolling.
Yeah.
You know, you're just watching those go by.
a lot of people died in those Northern California fires too. They just got stuck. There's nowhere to get out. And they apparently, like, that whole Napa area is, have you ever been up there?
No.
Damn, before the fires. I don't know what it looks like right now, but it, God, it was beautiful. It's where they do all the wine making, you know? And we actually went turkey hunting up there, me and Brian Callen.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, Steve Rinella took us up there, and we were up there, and we're like, God, this is so gorgeous. But it's like semi-rural, but then a big tourist vacation destination, too. It's like people come there for those wine tasting things and everything. Apparently, a giant chunk of that part of the state just got lit up.
Wow. And when you go turkey hunting, are you using a bow or are you using a shotgun?
Shotguns. This was for the meat eater show.
So do you have to like go for their heads. Head? Right. Yeah. So that's nuts. So because you can't hit their body or it goes everywhere, right?
Well, then you have to pull out all the lead, you know, which you like when people shoot smaller birds like pheasants and things along those lines, you do shoot the entire body. But with the turkey, you're basically sitting still and you call them in. You're like, bark, 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 and make this little, you get this little sound thing in your hand, or you have one in your mouth, you know, and you make little turkey calls, and the turkeys come in and just blast them in the head, or you shoot them in the body with a bow. I know my friend John Dudley and a lot of those guys, they hunt with bows and they shoot turkeys with a bow, but it's tricky because a turkey is a goddamn dinosaur, and if you don't hit it in the right spot, they'll just fly away with an arrow sticking out of them.
Wow.
Like literally.
Wow.
Something that kills a deer, like go right through a turkey, and the turkey's like, bitch, I'm out of here. Like, you have to catch them in their vitals, and their vitals are, you literally are shooting an arrow at a softball from, you know, 40 yards.
Yeah.
So you might not hit it.
Well, man, seeing this new space is awesome. I mean, this is an incredible new studio, and seeing that your targets are up there, you got, what, 48, 46?
47 yards.
47 yards.
Yeah, wow. Indoors, yeah. But when you come back, man, we'll have a full gym. You'll be able to work out and the whole deal.
Yeah. No, that's awesome.
Dude, after you watched the UFC and you saw Francis Ngannou, did you see if you could make 205?
That's,
I think a lot of people did. Oh, a lot of people are like, I could make 205. I think it's totally possible.
I've always been against it, but now I'm thinking about it. No, just kidding. But he is a monster.
He's terrifying.
A monster. To see how far he sent Overeem's head was just backwards in that one photo. That's like an iconic, that's probably the most iconic, at least in my mind, or epic heavyweight fighting, MMA fighting photo that there is. I mean, with that,
I think so
head
too.
Knocked back that way. And I mean, it just looked like such a power. I mean, it was a powerful punch, but the timing of that shot was just incredible. You see that one where his head is just completely knocked back? Man, he's a scary, scary dude.
I put that one on my Instagram feed too. That picture seems like the coming of the new king. You know what I mean? Like, obviously he's got to beat Stipe Miocic, but if you want to like look at a picture like in history when you come back and go, this is the moment where Ngannou arrived and people realize like, holy shit, like this guy is for real. He didn't just do that to any guy. He did that to Alistair motherfucking Overeem.
Yeah, K1 kickboxing world champion.
Yeah, Strikeforce world champion. Yeah. Just a stud. Like, elite fighter.
Yeah.
Number one heavyweight contender.
Yeah. Well, you and Brendan were talking about it last week on the show. And to hear you guys saying, if he starches him and if he can, if he can prove himself. And it's like, man, he just did it the best way possible.
And the way he did it, it's like the whole world's noticing. Mm. Like, I saw it on CNN. I saw it on all these different websites. And they're just, everyone's just raving like he could be the next big thing. And I think that's going to put him on the map now that everybody knows. And they have this highlight reel of his knockouts now.
Yeah.
And so the advertise a fight between him and Stipe, I think it's going to be gigantic.
Yeah, I think it's going to be huge. I've been able to talk with Stipe's coach, and there's a potential I was going to go out and help him in this training camp. So hopefully that still happens. My schedule's kind of crazy, but hopefully I can get up there for a week or sneak up there.
I'm happy for Stipe to get a big fight.
Yeah, for sure. Know?
And if he wins against Ngannou, I mean, that is just gigantic. Yeah. That would be absolutely phenomenal.
If there's a guy that can do it, I think it's Stipe for sure.
Well, he's the champ, and he's the champ for a reason.
Yeah, definitely.
But he's got a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
He's so big.
Got to weather that storm and put him up against the cage, wear him out, pummel. I mean, just get really heavy on him and tire him out, take him into deep waters, put him on his back.
We got to remember, Overeem did get him up against the cage.
Yeah, that's
true. Overeem lunged at him, clinched with him, got him up against the cage, but couldn't do a goddamn thing with him.
Yeah, that's true. I think a little difference is Stipe having that All-American wrestling background, being able to keep him there a little bit
more. This is crazy. He's opening up as the betting favorite over the heavyweight champion, Stipe Miocic. I mean, this is amazing. I mean, I get it. I understand. But that is pretty incredible that he's the betting favorite.
Yeah, I guess if you just look at his comment, that do MMA math or so, but the common opponent with them and Overeem and, you know, how they both performed against him.
Yeah. Well, Overeem did catch Stipe and had him stunned and knocked him on his ass, and then Stipe came back and won. But, you know, I mean, he's going to be obviously super aware of how dangerous it is to connect with Ngannou. He's going to obviously try to stay on the outside. And when he closes the distance, get that clinch, get him up against the cage, and figure out some way to either get that guy down or wear his legs out or do something. We don't know what happens when Ngannou goes into the third, fourth, and fifth rounds.
Right.
If anybody can even physically take him there.
Yeah. I do love how Stipe has that killer instinct, both against Overeem after getting hurt, even Verdum after his leg injury, being able
Junior
to come
Dos
back.
Santos, I think.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. You're right.
The Dos Santos fight, Dos Santos had kicked his leg pretty hard and giant swelling on his leg.
Yeah. Then to come back and just knock him out the way that he did was just beautiful.
Yeah.
So even if he gets hurt, if he doesn't get put out and he's hurt, he can still turn on that killer instinct and put him away. So it's going to be exciting. Like watching this fight, I'm amped for it. This is one of the big heavyweight fights recently that I'm just so stoked for.
Yeah, that's the big one. I think it's probably the biggest heavyweight fight ever when you think about what Ngannou is.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's obviously been some giant fights like Brock Lesnar when he fought Cain Velasquez, Brock Lesnar when he fought Overeem. Those are huge fights. But I think that Ngannou's something special. And if Stipe could figure out how to turn him down, how to shut him down and beat him, I mean, it will really cement his position as the baddest man on the planet. And if not, we got a new king.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's really exciting. I was even thinking when you're saying those last fights, this one I'm as excited for as whenever Brock fought Shane Carwin.
Yeah.
You know, me and Brennan both were helping Shane train for that fight. And now I might be involved for a week or so helping Stipe get ready for this one, just being around that, seeing their preparations, what they're going to do. Even just being a training partner for that legendary fight would be pretty epic.
Are you going to shave lightning bolts in your head to emulate Ngannou?
I'm at least going to dye black lightning bolts in my hair. Just be the reverse, vanilla gorilla version.
Have you trained with Stipe before?
I haven't. No? Just talked with his coaches a bit. So they thought it'd be a great idea, and I think it is too. So he's out there in Cleveland. I mean, he's got some incredible team around him.
And you're in Oklahoma City now, right?
Oklahoma City,
with Lovato. With Lovato. Yeah, that's awesome. And he's killing it out there, too.
Oh, my gosh. Well, he's undefeated, 7-0.
Strangling people.
Gosh.
And knocking people out, too, which is crazy.
He started boxing, or at least kickboxing, before he ever started jiu-jitsu.
Really?
So as a kid, his father and him, I don't know if you know, but they're the first ever American father-son Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belts. And, but they have this background of just everything.
That's awesome.
Since, like, you know, early 90s, just going and cross-training everywhere they could.
He's from that old school. Like, it goes like Hicks and Gracie, Salo Ribeiro, Shanji. And then, you know, he's in that group of those. That style of jiu-jitsu is just smush style. Oh, those guys have just tremendous pressure, basics. And when I say basics, I mean like the hard, polished, tried and true techniques. Mm-hmm. And it's like there's not like a lot of fancy, crazy new school stuff, but it's just laser sharp and just smashing power and pressure. Dude, such a big fan of that guy.
He's always talking about the pressure passing and just melting into into him, being a wet, hot blanket on top of him, just taking their air away, making them give up. And man, honestly, I've trained with guys like Carwin and Mir and Couture and Overeem, and I've trained with some of the biggest heavyweights around, and he is the only person, and he fights at 185. He's the biggest 185er I've ever seen. I can't imagine that. I don't know how he makes that cut, but he does it so in such an incredible way. He's the healthiest guy I've ever met, most disciplined athlete, most disciplined person I've ever been around in my entire life. Obsessed with discipline and training, the performance mindset or competitive mindset. The guy's the best I've ever been around, but he is the only person to ever make me completely claustrophobic underneath. I've never been claustrophobic underneath anyone, and he just takes my not in a weird way, but he takes my breath away.
And, not in a weird way.
Yeah. But I mean, just, he makes you want to quit. And he's always about putting yourself in the worst position possible and becoming uncomfortable, or being comfortable being uncomfortable, and just making yourself to where no matter where you get put, like, you're going to fight out of it. You're always just one step away from a finish, like you finishing them. Even if they're about to finish you, you're just a few small steps, just inches away from getting out of there, reversing it, taking their back, you know, putting them on their back and mounting and just finishing. And man, he's incredible. He's the only guy that I've ever seen be able to go through like 10 minute rounds, or 10 8-minute rounds back to back when he was training for the ADCCs.
Wow.
I mean, he's just an animal. No, 10 tens. It was 10 tens, and I was just blown away that he could do that, and we were having to rotate fresh guys on him.
Jesus.
And by the end of it, he got tired, but that was the only time I've ever seen him tired, like actually tired. And so he's just an absolute animal. It's a lifestyle for him. It's honestly so incredibly inspiring, and I feel like just being around him and me doing a lot of the same things, that's what's going to make me the Bellator heavyweight champ. But like just us feeding off each other, it's really cool dynamic. But if I can be half as disciplined as he is, I'll be the most disciplined heavyweight fighter there is.
Wow.
So it's pretty amazing being around him and his mindset and how he travels the world seeking out the top instructors in every discipline. I mean, he's going down to Brazil to Evolução Thai, that used to be, it's kind of like
in Chutebox, right?
Yeah, it used to be Chutebox. And
he goes in Curitiba, right?
Yep, Curitiba, yeah. And goes and soaks up those good vibes at the like largest waterfall in the world, or one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then is just in training camp
with
these guys.
Does he speak Portuguese?
He does. A lot of people mistake him as Brazilian, but his family's Spanish, and he grew up in Oklahoma City. So there's no Brazilian in him, but he speaks fluent Portuguese.
Where did he learn?
I think through jiu-jitsu, being around people, always trying to put himself in those situations. And then he would go down, I think he was a 16-year-old kid, and he would go down to Brazil sometimes by himself and stay for like a month or two.
Jesus.
I think he might have done it for 4 months at one time.
Wow.
So he's a really, really special individual. He's the guy that I've never seen take a break or take off. I mean, he competed. He fought 3 times in Bellator this year, 3-0. In between that, he had a super fight with Buchecha. He had another grappling tournament. He had the ADCCs. He was just going from every 2 months he was competing, every 2 months. But he was staying healthy the whole time too, which blew my mind, because he takes his we have a place called the ARC that we train at, the Athlete Recovery Center, and it's got hot and cold plunges and the infrared saunas and the cryotherapy and the just all sorts of stuff. Those Normatec boots, and our PTs there, and our strength conditioning coach is right there. So it's all in one shop. And so right after he's done training, he's recovering, where he gets there early and he's stretching out. And so the whole warming up truly and cooling down and taking care of your body and putting the right fuel in it, eating whole foods at all times, like just not putting garbage in your body. Man, he's going to be the Bellator middleweight champion probably pretty soon. I think they have that maybe lined up in the next 2 or 3 fights.
I'm excited. I'm excited to see him compete against like really upper echelon guys like Musasi, along those lines.
Yeah, the guy he just fought, Chris Honeycutt, was in the NCAA finals. That was the first high-level wrestler that he's competed against. He won every single round. The first 6 fights, he finished everybody. And so it's going to be exciting. If there's someone watching this that hasn't, you know, watched Rafael Lovato Jr. compete, whether it's in grappling or MMA, like go follow him, because he's going to do it. He's going to be a champ.
Yeah, he's a savage for sure. What does he weigh before he makes the cut to 185?
So I don't want to put a specific number, but I think it's around 210, 215, 220, something like that. So I know whenever he's in camp, he's trying to walk around at less than 200 when he can.
And he's about like, what, 6'2"?
No, he's 6'4".
6'4"?
6'4", and he's got like some of the longest reach.
Damn.
Yeah, he's
at
least
6'4". He gets down to 185. That's crazy. Mm-hmm. And if you see,
probably a size 13, 14.
His Instagram, and you could see a picture of him with his shirt off. Homeboy is fucking shredded.
Shredded, man.
He's got to be in the neighborhood of like 8 or 9% body fat.
Yeah.
Zero. but just jacked and shredded.
Just as a heavyweight, I've always just envied anyone that was under 15 or whatever. So
yeah, there he is. I mean, come on, son.
Yeah, just shredded. And he looks down at every guy he's ever fought. I mean, if you see other weigh-in photos, like they're all looking up at him, like literally their chin's up in the air.
I'm sure. And he went through a pretty significant injury a few years back, right? Didn't he have like a pec tear or something?
Yeah, I think it was the is there a pec tendon or something,
something like that?
I think it was the tendon in there that connects like the shoulder and the pec, and completely tore it and had to have reconstructive surgery. And man, the guy's so disciplined. I mean, he went through like anyone, all of us athletes would, being bummed out a bit. But, you know, he had this machine that was, you know, moving his arm up and down and, you know, just sitting there. But then the guy is a planner, a visualizer. Like, he takes advantage, even the times he's not on the mat, he's structuring his life around it to where he's writing down his goals and his dreams and this month's plan, the next 3 months' plan, this week's plan, this day's plan. I'm just writing every single thing out so that way he can make sure that he's doing everything he can. Even when he's not training, he's training. You know, he's training his mind. He's training everything for that so that he can perform at the best. And I think that's why he competes at such a high level. And I'm speaking about him like this, but it's all true. It's all honest. I'm not just trying to give the guy props. Like he earned that from me at least. And I think he should from pretty much anyone he competes with because, man, I mean, his match with Buchecha even was so competitive. Mm-hmm. He could have easily won that match. He could have won the ADCCs. I mean, easily.
Buchecha's a big fellow too.
Yeah, I know. Like 245 of just like, just.
And then world class.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, won the ADCCs, I think, four.
Now, I'm a big Lovato fan. I think he's awesome. I'm excited to see. I always love when the highest level guys in any discipline enter into MMA. You know, and when you see a guy like him who's just jiu-jitsu phenom, and now he's like, okay, now I'm going to try to take over MMA. Or a guy like Gokhan Saki enters into the UFC, like, oh, okay, let's see what happens when you get like a real high level guy in any discipline who enters into MMA. It's always interesting because they're such specialists. Because most MMA fighters, you know, pretty good at wrestling, pretty good at jiu-jitsu, pretty good at kickboxing, but not elite, like world class, world championship level at any different discipline.
Yeah.
So when you see a guy who is like Rafael Lovato, who is world class at jiu-jitsu, like world championship level, and then enters into MMA, it's like, what you going to do when he grabs you?
Yeah, absolutely. Like a Damian totally Maya. World. Yeah, that's who Rafael is. And seeing...
Or Verdum.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And something special about Rafael, you know, and then... But anyways, he's... he can coach it so incredibly well too. Mm. And that's not always the case with a lot of athletes. I've been coached by a lot of incredible wrestlers. Kenny Monday, Kendall Cross, they were incredible coaches. Cale Sanderson, I've been coached on the mats by Dan Gable and some other guys. So absolute legends. And his coaching is also just so thorough and so exact. And it's like you see the guy at the top right now who's performing at the best. And he's able to teach it at such a high level that's why he's, you know, coached up some other grappling world champions and stuff like that. And now his focus is on MMA. It's just perfect timing that him and I got to train together for a full year now and taking in 2018. Both of us want to be, you know, hunting down those belts.
Did you move down to Oklahoma City specifically to train with him?
There was a few reasons. But yeah, that was one of the big ones. I was going to regardless, because Water 4 is based out of there and Fight for the Forgotten is underneath Water 4. And so we're partners with them. And they've taken over all the administrative stuff and we're officially an initiative under Water 4.
That's nice.
Yeah, man, it's incredible. So stoked that they're making things just flourish. We're going to serve over 200,000 people with clean water this year.
That's so incredible. And we're doing a benefit tonight at the Comedy Store.
Yeah. And it's going to be incredible.
Super pumped. One of many. I think we're going to start doing these all the time there. I just thinking we do shows there all the time.
So cool.
And most of the time we just do shows. And I'm like, well, why shouldn't we just do shows? I mean, couple times a month or so, just donate all the money. So that's what we're going to do.
Man, I'm blown away by it. So stoked. I just found out right before we got on the podcast that there's a generous donor out of Oklahoma City, and he's going to match whatever comes in today on the website, whether that's at the Comedy Store or now, up to $10,000. So
beautiful.
The first $10,000 will be matched, and so that first $10,000 will be doubled. It'll turn into $20,000. So just so stoked. So whatever comes in through the doors, man, it can be doubled.
That's beautiful, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, like the first time we did this, we got Bitcoin from people. And they donated Bitcoin. And I have that Bitcoin on my phone and I have to get it off the phone. But that Bitcoin is now worth like $50,000. So what I did was I took that Bitcoin, I took the cash version of it, and I donated it to Water 4, and then I matched it. And now we're up to, so all that additional money is yours too. Like, it's not mine.
Oh, my
gosh. So it's yours. So it's like there's an additional $45,000 in there. Yeah, so we got to get it off. Get it off the phone. But that'll go to water for us.
Oh, man. I can't. This isn't fake. I can't fake this kind of smile, no, man.
I'm happy,
so awesome.
Too, man. Yeah, and it's the thing is, that, like, do you keep it in there for a while? Because if you keep it in there for a while, it might be worth even more. Do you bail now? Yeah,
it might go way up.
Oh, well, then we can keep
way,
it in there.
Way up.
Like, how way?
Like, speculation in the next 6 to 12 months is at least 20,000, if not 50,000.
Whoa.
But that's, like, way high speculation. I'm not
buying
into all of that. All right.
Well, this is what I'll do. I'll leave it up to you guys. We'll get the Bitcoin off the phone, and then I'll essentially leave it up to you guys when you want to pull the trigger and take the money out of it.
Okay.
Because that seems to be the right. Because, like,
well, let's get some advisors to tell us.
You know what? I'm going to get Andreas Antonopoulos. He's going to be on the podcast soon.
Okay.
And he's the guy who set up all this Bitcoin stuff for me in the first place. The Bitcoins all came in as donations. So just so anybody knows, like, because some people accused me of not donating that money to you. And I had explained to them, no, I took the Bitcoin and I just, whatever the money value of it was, then I gave that to you guys.
For sure.
So, but
I remember that.
But the what's left, I still, it's not mine. It's you know, just because I have it, but it's not mine. It's yours. So it is all donation. That's just... I thought as a science project, I'm like, let's just see what happens with this shit. I don't want to take it out.
It could have been zero.
Didn't want to turn it into money. I didn't want to cash it out. Mm. So I said, let me just give you guys whatever money it is, and I'll hold on to that, and I'll see what happens with it. But now it's worth 50 grand.
Wow, that's nuts.
So yeah. More than that, it's like 65.
Oh, so. Jesus.
Yeah, it keeps going up. It's like on a crazy spike right now.
Wow, it's now worth $13,000?
Yeah,
holy
each
shit.
Coin is, yeah.
Whoa,
that's five or so coins.
That's crazy. And I will also put out my Bitcoin address once I get it off the phone for you guys if you want to donate money. And again, all of that money, none of it goes to me. It's all going to go to Water For. It's all going to go to Fight for the Forgotten, which is the shirt that I'm wearing. And that's what the benefit is tonight at the Comedy Store. All the money is going to Fight for the Forgotten. And you can donate too at, what is the website?
It's fightfortheforgotten.org/donate.
And if you guys haven't paid attention to any Justin's podcast before, I'll give you a brief rundown. Justin was on The Ultimate Fighter, fought for the UFC for a while, and then found his true calling going to the Congo and building wells for the pygmies. And it's just an amazing story. You could watch some of the podcasts. You could watch some of the short clips on you. And I know there's a documentary on you that's coming out soon as well.
Yeah, I think it's going to be the summer of 2018. And so thank you so much for even doing a sit-down interview on that.
Oh, my pleasure.
It's going to add a whole lot of value to the film and just give it a louder voice or a wider reach. Because my first promise to the Pygmies, and this was even man, I'm just so thankful for the support of this community and personally you, because, man, when I first came on, we hadn't drilled any wells. In fact, I had just had Andy Bowe, I had held him, and he's a 1.5-year-old boy that I held as he passed away, and it wrecked me. It changed me, but I knew we were going to do something with water. I just knew it. But my first time on the podcast, there were zero wells drilled. I was just going to go there and live for a year, and hopefully we were going to build an incredible team. You know, that team is now 20 strong, full-time, 12 part-time, been able to drill 70 water wells now.
That's amazing.
70 communities have been transformed. If that Bitcoin is 50 grand, I mean, 4,200.
65, he said.
Oh, 65 grand. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Well, I'm not a math whiz, so I fight for a living. But it's $4,200 transforms a community. It helps our teams go out there and survey the land. We have a survey team now that gets to go out and scout it out beforehand, tell our teams what tools to bring out and what obstacles to expect. So that's a few hundred dollars, $400 or $500 to go survey. Then to drill the wells, around $2,700. And then to help the community and really teach and train them. So we educate the locals with the knowledge on how to drill the wells. We equip them with the tools to be able to do it.
How many of them can read?
So of our well drillers, everyone. Well, I think everyone can. A lot of them have even graduated from a university with community development degrees.
I mean the people that live in
the Mabuti
Congo.
Pygmies.
Yeah.
The Mabuti Pygmies, none of them. I've met two people, I think, two, maybe three that can actually read, and they're the chiefs. One of them is actually an incredible guy, Chief Alondo. His grandson's Jippy, and he's going to be chief one day, and that's like my favorite little guy over there. And Jippy's in school now, and there's a long story with that, but it's one of the first times ever the Mobutu Pygmies have ever been in school, and sustainably, to where they can even pay their school fees, and they can have food there because they can buy the food. But traditionally, they don't have a written language. They don't have a calendar, so they don't know their age. And so they're really, really traditional hunter-gatherer society that's just incredible. You'd love them. They're, you know, with the bows, they're deadly. I've seen a little boy, probably 8, 9, 10 years old, climb up. The canopy of the rainforest is probably, it's well over 100 feet. It's probably 150, 200 feet. And seen a guy shimmy up there, 8, 9, 10 years old, to the top. And with a bow on his, like, hung around his neck. And so he goes up there, and then he's sniping, you know, parrots or other kind of birds.
They eat parrots?
Anything can find, man. Yeah. So one thing that they do, I don't know why this popped in my mind, but if they're running and they're hunting after an antelope and a bee flies by, they're going to chase that bee to the hive because they honey to them is like gold. I mean, it's they love honey, having something sweet. So they'll risk their lives to climb up into the trees. They set a fire at the bottom of the tree, let the smoke go up, and then they climb up there and they just reach in. And these are African bees. These are killer bees that they're reaching into the honey hive and just pulling it out and dropping it down in a basket or just plopping it down
and just getting
leaves.
Jacked. With just getting stones, jacked. Huh?
Sometimes two people go up there, and one guy's purpose is just to have like a twig and leaves that he's hitting the bees off of the guy reaching in.
Jesus Christ.
He's just protecting them. But then when those guys come back into the village and they have this just treasure pot of honey, the whole village celebrates their heroes. And, you know, because they literally did risk their lives for their wives, for their kids, so that they could have some honey.
Wow.
And they save it, they savor it. And it's pretty incredible. Another thing they do is if they're on a hunt and they find a turtle, they'll actually make it look almost like the kids here that have like Ninja Turtle backpacks.
Mm-hmm.
They'll tie a vine around the feet of the turtle and then they put it on their back and then they go back to hunting. And if they get an animal, if they get like
an
antelope.
Do they kill the turtle first?
No, they just keep it alive and it's on their back. And if they get a kill of an antelope or a wild hog or something like that, they actually let the turtle go. And then they only take what they need. So they respect the forest and its resources so much. So they only keep what they need.
What a fucking tumultuous ride for that poor turtle.
Yeah, you're right.
It's like, Jesus, right, I hope these motherfuckers find a pig.
But but if they don't, then they have food and dinner later for their kids.
Right.
And so they bring it back and they'll just cut it open and put it on the fire and boil it.
Did you eat turtle? Have you eaten?
I have eaten turtle there.
What's it like?
It's not the best. It's really gamey and it's really, really chewy, the kind that I had.
Mm.
And I don't know what part I had, but I've had even monkey there. This was before I was there during the Ebola breakout and everything.
Jesus.
I didn't know that you get it from eating monkey. And so they just, they eat monkey all the time there.
Oh my God.
I've eaten monkey several times now, probably five, six, seven times.
Wow. What does it taste like?
It's going to sound goofy, but it's super tender. It was some of the best meat I've had. The one they gave me, I think it was part of like the around the femur bone or whatever.
Does it freak you out to eat a primate?
It didn't. No. Really? At first, I thought it was kind of crazy. And then after I tasted it, it was really, really good. And so after that, I mean, it's good.
My friend Steve Rinella went to, where was it in South America that he went to? I cannot remember. But he was down there hunting with this tribe, and they prefer monkey over everything.
Oh, man, it's that good.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why. It's good. Really good. I'm not just saying that. I mean, it's really good. And they celebrate whatever monkey size they bring back, whether it's a big one or a little guy, they're gonna really celebrate because that's some of the – they call it the sweet meat. So,
where does it say he's at? Yeah, they're eating monkey stew. Does it say where he's at?
Bolivia.
Bolivia, that's it. Yeah, that's
I think there's even a YouTube video. Sometimes people can go check out on my YouTube channel of me trying monkey for the first time. I thought they were teasing me. And so at the end, I go, no, this is chicken. It's got to be chicken. And they're like, no, it's monkey. And after I got off, they walked me outside to where the monkey like carcass was still there and everything. And I was like, dang, this is real. Like, it's really, really, really good. And I said it tastes like chicken.
Yeah, so, that's funny because Ranella said it tasted like a smoked turkey leg.
Yeah,
it's like the way they cook it. They cooked it over like
the meat,
like wet leaves over the fire.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just.
So man, it's awesome, and we're about to get 2,000 to 3,000 more acres monkeys? Of land. Oh yeah, monkeys.
We got a monkey harvest coming in.
I hope so, but no.
I don't think I'd be a hunter if that was all you could hunt was monkeys. Yeah. I'd be like, I think I'm going vegan. Yeah. Or at least a vegetarian.
Coming back here, you know, my wife like shed a tear, I think, because I ate a monkey.
Really?
Yeah. I mean she was like, you ate a what? So I think she still thinks I just had one instead of five or six.
Oh, well, now she knows.
Oh, yeah. Whoops. Oh, actually, man. Yeah, she does now because of this. But, man, it's such an adventure living out there. And so to be able to empower the locals to do it for themselves is just so key. Like that's, I guess the message I'm preaching is just the opportunity is greater than charity.
That's why I asked you if they could read, if it's like, do you give them instruction manuals, how to maintain and how to, the upkeep for wells or how to build a new one or.
So with the pygmies, they're involved in helping us get our equipment out there. I mean, sometimes our hikes are from the nearest quote unquote road, which none of us would call a road at all. And the same drive, some of the times the drive to the beginning of the rainforest where from the airport is 6 hours, the same exact drive has taken 24 hours or 48 hours. We had to dig out like 40 cars in front of us one time because they were just stuck in the mud, and to get around it. So, but once we get to the rainforest, it can take an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours to hike each way. And so a round trip with 1 ton of well drilling equipment is a lot. So the whole village helps us. I mean, there's an incredible Swahili proverb that basically says, if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go together. And so I think it's beautiful because they don't even let us do all the work alone. Mm. They know that we're going to come in there and help them with something that's so precious, that's life-saving, life-giving to them. So they all send 100 people to come help us with our equipment. And so what used to take us days to take in, you know, it takes us just that one trip. And so they help us get it in there. They build us huts. So basically they build us a home, just like what they live in. Very hospitable, give us our food while we're there.
They must
us.
Be so happy that you showed up. Can you imagine some big white dude from America out of nowhere? Just like, hey, I'm going to live with you guys and make wells. They'd be like, yeah, sure you are. Nobody ever come down here and made a well. Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you made 70 wells now. They must be like, how is this possible?
Yeah, well, what I love is the heroes of this are our 32 well drillers. We even have now, I got to share on your podcast last time that Pacha Soap, which was inspired even by this podcast, him listening to this, working at night, the night shift, and having a dream to start up Pacha Soap, which is in Whole Foods, and they got another brand that's in Target. It's super successful. And
that's awesome.
Yeah, they're helping us buy land there in the Congo, and we're starting up a soap production facility. So we have an essential oil press, and we're hiring the locals to be able to get all the essential oils like eucalyptus and avocado oil and palm oil and different raw materials, because the only thing they have available to them right now is car washing soap that's literally from China or from India. It's just packed with chemicals. Right. When I used it, it left me raw. I mean, like in pain from it.
And yeah, you're better off with no soap at all, just washing yourself with dirt.
Right. And so,
by the way, you can do that if people don't know.
Yeah.
If you just take dirt, like if you're somewhere and there's no soap, just take dirt and just literally use water and mud and just wash yourself with the dirt and then rinse it all off. You're just trying to scrub off the bullshit. And dirt is probably better for you than antibiotic soaps.
Mm. Yeah. For sure. And so we're about to get 2,000 to 3,000 acres more of land. So we have 3,000
there
now.
That's awesome, man.
And it's about to be 5,000 to 6,000 acres.
What if we reach out? And reach out to people, because I know a lot of people do like to go to places like that and teach English. Hmm. What if there was a way, or what would be the language to teach that would be most beneficial for them down there?
So language-wise is really tough because
do they speak?
There's over 200 spoken languages in Congo, over 200. And so there's 5 national languages. The government and schools and hospitals is French. It was colonized by Belgium, and that's a nuts story. But then they also speak Swahili in the east. They speak Lingala in the west. They speak Banakongo, and there's one more that I'm missing.
You talk to them, what do you talk to them with?
So I have very, very broken Swahili, very, very broken Swahili. But the Swahili they speak there is it's mixed with a little bit of French. And also the local language. So you've got to truly live there.
Right.
And over the last 6 years, I've been there for about maybe a year and seven, eight, year, 9 months, boots on the ground, a year at one time. And then, the saying about Swahili is that it was born in Tanzania. It got sick in Kenya. It died in Uganda, and they took it to the Congo to bury it because they can't communicate with anyone in Uganda, not truly communicate and
wow.
get their point across. So it's really tough.
What I meant
really
by teaching them English is teaching them how to read.
Yeah.
Like, I just think that if you could somehow or another teach them some language where they could read and write things down, and you could just keep this thing going.
Yeah.
With them while they're there.
What I think is really cool is now we've got this video up on on YouTube. It's Chief Leome's transformation. And so Chief Leome in his village, it was just an incredible transformation. They had never owned land of their own, but Chief Leome remembered his grandfather used to actually take him to hunt on that land that they now own. And so now it's theirs, and his grandson's going to be able to say, you know, this was my grandfather's land, just like he's able to say, you know, I used to hunt with my grandfather here. But so from the land that they have land, water, and food. There they have about 500 acres, I believe. And so then they have their own water, and now they've grown so many banana trees there. They used to get paid 1 to 2 bananas a day for labor. From sun up to sundown, a banana or two a day. Now they have hundreds and hundreds of banana trees. I mean, probably 500-600 banana trees in that one village.
Wow.
And from that, they're able to go sell it. When they sell it, they can buy their own clothes for the first time. They can now pay school fees so that they can actually go to the local school and learn to read and write. It's a little bit of a hike for them, but they can go learn and read and write. And so it's the first time that, I mean, it could even create an opportunity for the Mabuti Pygmies to have representation at their version of Congress in the Congo for the
wow.
first time ever. There's over 200 tribes represented there. The only one not represented is the Mabuti Pygmies. And so to get them educated, the excuse used to be from the government was they're not really people. They're part man, part animal. That was the government saying that, I think, in the early 2000s.
Jesus Christ.
Maybe the late 90s, but early 2000s, they were saying they were half man, half animal, that they'll never have representation. But now it's started to shift to where we even have a governor, the governor of the largest state in Congo, sponsoring everything we do, you know, endorsing it, saying, hey, you have free range of the Ituri region, and we want you to drill here, and we want you to drill there. And so he's actually come on our side and said, the work you guys are doing is really great because it's through the locals, it's locally led. And so to have that opportunity, once some of the Mabuti Pygmies are educated, have a high school education, maybe we can get them to a local university there or right next door, maybe in Uganda, Rwanda, Kenya, then they can go back and they can actually start representing themselves. Because now they say, if they're educated, then we can, but none of them are educated.
Right.
So it would draw out the process longer, but now they're, you know, the next generation will be.
And that's what's inspired you also to get back into MMA again.
Yeah.
And that inspired you to sign up with Bellator. And since then, you've had three fights. And won all three.
Yep.
And now you're one of the top Bellator heavyweight contenders.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy because when we first talked, you hadn't fought in a long time. And you were
5 years, 2 months.
Yeah. And you weren't training. You were just kind of like going back and forth to the Congo. And then,
right.
you know, that had to be a crazy thing to just get back into it after all that time out.
It was the hardest thing I've ever done, physically at least.
I'm sure, to get yourself back in that kind of shape.
In between my first and second fight back, I had malaria again, and that was my third time to have that.
He's got malaria three times, folks, by the way.
Yeah, and so that time I got malaria while I was there. Because it was so bad, I broke out in shingles, which, you know, being 30, just now turning 30, so then I was like 28 or 29. To have shingles, the doctor's like, you're too young for this. And my body was just that stressed out.
Too young for shingles?
Yeah.
I've heard of people getting shingles.
Well,
like fighters.
I guess normally, that might be like infantigo or Matt Herpes, something
right.
like that. But they did the culture or whatever, and it was mm-hmm. shingles. And it's supposed to be an older generation thing, I think. And
no kidding. I didn't know shingles. Is it
I think
because
they say it starts like 40 and beyond.
Is it a compromised immune issue? Is that what it is? The idea?
Mm-hmm. And so it's actually chicken pox coming back out in your body. So if you haven't had chicken pox, you can't have shingles. And so it's like it lays dormant in your body. And then once you get into older age or your immune system is compromised, then shingles can reappear.
That is the most fucked up thing about the human body, that it harbors these bacteria and they sit there waiting, just waiting, biding my time to fuck up your life.
Yeah.
Waiting.
Yeah. And so then I had, I had that. Then I had shingles, and then I came back, and for a month or 2 months, the doctors were trying to figure out what was wrong with me because I was clear of malaria. But the CDC did 2 tests on me for malaria again, but they found out I had dengue fever.
So Jesus
every night I was going to sleep, I was waking up, and that was probably...
Did you tell them you ate a monkey?
I did. And then they
did
wanted
they look
to...
look at you like sideways? Like, the fuck, bro?
They wanted to do the quarantine thing on me. But it had been over 3 months since Ebola had broken out, and it had been 3 months since I'd been back.
What happened to Ebola? Ebola was like going to kill us all just like a year ago. Remember? Everybody's freaking out. That one lady who's a nurse who wouldn't be quarantined. She's like, fuck you. I'm going outside. Like, no, she's going to kill us all. You selfish bitch.
So Ebola was actually discovered in Congo. There's a river called the Ebola River.
Oh, great.
And so that's where it was discovered. And it actually came back. It broke out since the big crazy one. It broke out. And I think it was like less than 100 people. It might've been like 10. Or less. And so they really were able to contain it, which is impressive to be able to do in Congo because it's not as organized as anywhere else. But on the MMA journey back, it was really, really tough. I mean, the muscle memory just was not there. I had lost the wrestling I grew up with. And the cardio obviously wasn't there after 5 years off. But the sicknesses, other things, my body was healed. The muscles and joints and ligaments and all that. I think I felt better than ever there. It was just the muscle memory wasn't coming back, and the cardio was really tough, and I had to shed some weight.
The muscle,
just get healthy.
The muscles and the cartilage and the joints and everything like that, they probably benefited from all that time off, right?
I think so, a lot.
Because so many guys get, by the time you're 30, I mean, how many MMA fighters have like really huge injuries by the time they're 30, 31 years old? It's pretty common.
Yeah, I started fighting at 19 years old professionally, MMA. And so, and I was always the young guy in the heavyweight division. And so now just turning 30, I feel like I got a lot of miles left on me having those 5 years off. And so
a lot of life experience too, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I honestly think a lot of people are like, oh, so you took off and that's probably impossible. For me, it was a whole other kind of training. I mean, kind of like I was talking about Rafael and being comfortable, being uncomfortable. Mm. I mean, I've slept in the mud, woke up in the mud, at least slept on the dirt, woke up in the mud because the rain came so hard, and sleeping under twig and leaf huts on the dirt, you know, no mattress underneath, you know, anything. And so, man, to have that, to battle through the sicknesses, to see what they suffer from and how they dig deep on a daily basis, they're in survival mode, and to see the battles they fight, and then to have, you know, 32 of my heroes there that have drilled 70 wells, that whenever a bridge collapses because a truck is illegally logging and they overloaded their weight and they just collapse this 1930s bridge. And then I think, oh, it's going to be impossible. And then they get out of the truck, they start walking through the water with all our well drilling equipment, and we're going to find another way. We're going to get taxi motorcycles to ride in everything we needed, this big truck to carry in. And so it's going to take a lot longer. It's going to be a lot harder, but we're going to get it done, and we're going to win this fight.
So you feel like that was a training sort of tool for you?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to say this, but or I don't want to compare it to this, but it's almost like it was a life experience, and kind of like some of our Navy guys, Navy SEALs, where they do the special forces training. I think this was my version of like kind of special training for me as a fighter. It enlarged my heart, or deepened the well of who I am. And so I think I just have more of a motivation to go in there and win than
any
other
guy. It
feels
like your submission game has really come up a lot now.
Yeah.
It just
so
seems
I have the
like
wrestling,
it. Yeah.
And now my submission game is on point. Being with
You're a blue belt now under Lovato.
Right.
Nice.
Yeah, and I wanted to do it the right way. I wanted to do it the way that every other student does it. And so it was really cool to get that. I didn't know that would mean so much to me, but it really did.
Crazy, right?
Yeah, it's nuts, man. It's nuts how that award, or that promotion, is a milestone in my martial arts journey.
That's why it's so good for kids. Martial arts are so good for kids because it gives them a tangible representation of their hard work. Mm. Like you give them a belt and they tie on that belt and they have this giant smile on my face. You know, when my kids take martial arts and when they get a new belt, they have this giant smile on their face. They're so happy and they jump around. They look at it. They want to wear it home and
that was me.
Squeeze it. Yeah, me too, man. I remember when I got my blue belt, I was like, holy shit, I'm not a white belt anymore. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, you feel like I made it over the hump. And what they say is if you can make it to purple belt, you can make it to black belt.
Yeah.
It's the blue belt is like you're just working hard. If you work hard, you get there. Hey, you know, you're not at white belt anymore. But if you can get to purple belt, like, hey, man, just keep going and you can be a black belt.
Yeah. And in Lovato's school of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, it says a black belt is a white belt who never quit.
Yeah. And so that's just a great quote. Big. I've heard that before. Yeah, I like it, man. It's an interesting time now for jiu-jitsu and MMA. It really is, because you're seeing like some guys like this weekend, Brian Ortiz, Ortega is fighting Cub Swanson. And Brian Ortega, I'm trying to remember his nickname, T-City.
T-City,
Triangle
right.
City. He's got one of the best guards in MMA.
Yeah.
And Ortega is fucking nasty off of his back. I mean, he's just... good.
Do you think he lulls them to sleep with his baby blue eyes?
Beautiful face, his long flowing locks, just like you. Yeah, so Brian is, in my opinion, probably the best guy in the division off of his back. I don't think there's anybody that could fuck with him at 145, especially now that Charles Oliveira is moved up to 55. I think he's the best at 45. His fucking submission game is so lightning fast and just... tight as can be. But Cub Swanson's a black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu too.
Yeah.
And Cub is a nasty striker too and super unorthodox, like real weird. But Brian is a fucking great striker too. And Brian is un-motherfucking defeated. 12-0 with one no contest. So
an interesting fight.
Fuck yeah, it is. It's like it's a real crossroads fight in a lot of ways because Cub is at the top of the heap in the 145-pound division. He's lost to some of the big guys like Max Holloway, lost to Frankie Edgar, but he's still really respected and thought of as one of the top guys in the division. And Ortega, being this young prodigy at 12-0, has this opportunity now to fight one of the most crafty veterans in the division.
Sounds like a similar opportunity that Nagano just had, that Francis just had, you know, to be that young lion, to come up and... throw in a guy and really announce himself as one of the top contenders.
Ortega can submit anybody in the world. I really believe that. And he'll box with you, too. The thing about Ortega is, like, he'll make it seem like there's no intention whatsoever to go to the ground. And then sometimes he boxes guys up, and then when they want to take him to the ground because they don't like the stand-up, that's when they're Foxville. Mm. He's got an interesting strategy in that regard because in the last fight, I was thinking, like, wow, this is kind of interesting. We're in the third round. He still has not tried to submit this guy. Like, that's his game. And then, boom, they go to the ground, and he instantly catches him with a guillotine. But the reason they went to the ground, his opponent took him down because he didn't like the stand-up.
That's smart.
Yeah, so
his
stand-up keeps coming up higher and higher and higher. But when it comes to jiu-jitsu, he's one of the very best in the sport. He's really good.
How far away is he from here, where he trains?
He's close. He's in Black House. Black House is in Compton. Or that area. So it's, I don't know if it's exactly Compton. It's Compton adjacent. But so there's that. Go to the 219 card. Oh, you know what? Go to the fucking the Fox card. That's a big one. That is, that one right there.
Oh, man.
Robbie Lawler, Rafael dos Anjos. Good.
Former lightweight and welterweight champ.
Yeah, man, that is fucking interesting.
And he's been doing so great, man.
Yeah, well, like Lovato.
Yeah.
I mean, Dos Anjos, what he has done in going up from 155 to 170, there was like, well, he was the champ, but he lost to Eddie Alvarez. Well, let's see how he does at 170. Looks way better. I mean, he's steamrolling people. The way he fucked up Neil Magny, leg kicked him to the ground, took him to the ground, smushed him. Yep. I mean, he beat Tarek Saffiedine in a stand-up fight, which is like, wow. Saffiedine is world-class striker.
Yeah, Neil's a buddy of mine, and he is an absolute monster. And to have seen that fight, I mean, Rafael Dos Anjos looks incredible at this weight.
Yeah, it's very interesting because I think he's supposed to be at 170 all along. Mm. It's not like he's a big 155er that's made it up to 170, but he's kind of small at 170. No, he looks like a 170. And, of course, he's fighting one of the best 170s ever in the former champ, Robbie Lawler. So that should be a perfect fight for Fox because, you know, just for fun. I mean, it's going to be a chaotic fight. There's never been a goddamn boring Robbie Lawler fight ever.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't even know how to have a boring fight.
Very, very, very true. What do you think of the Lamas fight?
I like it, but Lamas was obviously training for Aldo.
Right.
And so, you know, he gets this change of guard. Now he's fighting Josh Emmett, who's a tough customer. And Emmett, a lot of people don't know him, but he's 12-1. It's a good fight. Very good fight.
I'm excited to see how that goes out.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm excited about that, but I'm also excited about the Ponzinobbio-Mike Perry fight.
Yeah.
I almost want this fight to just happen so Darren Till can fight Mike Perry. I'm almost rooting for Mike Perry just so he can get out of it and they can make that Darren Till-Mike Perry fight. Because if they do decide to make that, because I know they tried to make Mike Perry versus Wonder Boy, and Dana even announced it, and Wonder Boy was like, hey, slow the fuck down. Like, the guy had one fight in the UFC. I just fought for the title twice and then beat Jorge Masvidal.
Right.
And then you're going to have me fight this guy, like, right away? Like, this is crazy. And, by the way, my thumbs hurt. He had, like, injuries in his thumbs. He was like, he got his thumbs. He was talking about it after the fight that he fucked up the tendons in his thumbs when I was interviewing him. He's like, something happened to my hand. I thought it broke it. I'm not sure. So he's got a lot of rest to go through. So Darren Till's looking for an opponent. And they were talking about Darren Till versus Kamaru Usman, which is very exciting as well. Because Kamaru Usman, who's slated, go to UFC 219. Usman is slated to fight against Meek Mill.
I've known him since we were 15. Usman. We grew up wrestling together.
Emil Meek.
Yeah.
Meek Mill's a rapper.
Meek Mill's a rapper, right. Yeah, what the fuck's wrong with me? Emil Meek, who is the crazy Viking motherfucker.
In high school, people called Usman U.S. Man for some reason.
Just because of the way it's spelled?
Yeah.
But he's a terrifying guy.
He is.
He's one of the most terrifying guys in the sport.
What I love seeing is, I think in high school, our senior year, I think he graduated, I think he finished his senior year fourth in the state of Texas. So number four in wrestling. And then he went on to UNK or Nebraska Kearney. And
never fought Meek Mill. Emil Meek is a scary guy.
Yeah.
And was really looking forward to this fight. And then there was some talk of the fight night taking place because Emil couldn't get his visa sorted out. But then he got it sorted out. And Kamaru Usman was saying, hey, you know, I've already moved on. And then so lately, Emil Meek's Instagram and his Twitter has been calling Kamaru Usman a chicken and saying he's ducking him and all kinds of crazy shit. So I do not know if this is official. I'm hoping that this is official because someone needs to challenge Usman. I think Usman is one of the most dangerous and scary guys in the division, and he's not being talked about.
Someone in the top 10 that he's earned that spot, I think.
I believe so, too. There's so many tough guys in that division that he's sort of kind of been overlooked, in my opinion. And to me, when I watch him fight, I'm like, Jesus Christ, this guy's a handful for everybody. I think Usman, pull that card back up, please. I think Usman is just, he's got all the tools. He's in his prime. He's fucking super dangerous everywhere. Super dangerous standing up, smashes people on the ground. Really fucking strong for the division. Top game, out of control. You know, we don't know what happens when he gets put on his back. We don't know what happens if he gets tagged, if he fights a world-class striker that could stand up. But what Emil Meek brings to the table is nasty power and a real warrior spirit.
Yeah.
I mean, Emil, he came into the UFC after a KO victory over Husamar Palhares.
I remember that.
Yeah, I remember I watched that. I was like, get this guy in the UFC, please.
Right now. Yeah.
Like, he's a fucking animal. And the thing is, everybody's running away from Kamaru Usman except Emil Meek. And maybe Meek Mill. We haven't asked him.
Yeah, he said Colby Covington's ducking him too right now.
Oh, Kamaru Usman said that?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course he is. Everybody's ducking him. But also, Colby would be wise because Colby's made so much noise after beating Damian Maya. And he's trying to get a fight with Tyron Woodley. He's trying to, like, he's trying to promote himself. And the worst way to promote yourself is to fight Kamaru Usman. But Emil Meek is like, get me in there, bitch. Let's do it. So I sincerely hope that this fight actually takes place because I think it's a fucking wicked, wicked fight. And I want to see if Emil has any answers for the problems that Kamaru Usman brings to the octagon because no one has so far. And, I mean, he's got one loss in his record. I do not know if that was in the UFC or outside the UFC. But in the last few fights we've seen him since he's won the Ultimate Fighter, he's just been unstoppable. But again, not getting the credit that he deserves. Yeah, it's all of his fights inside the octagon seem to be all victories.
He's one of the most naturally athletic guys that I've ever known. That's what I meant by growing up wrestling with him. He started wrestling in high school and finished fourth in the state, but then he went on to the NCAA's Division II and just won two national titles or maybe three, and he's a stud.
Well, the big fight for me on this card is not just the title fight between Cyborg and Holly Holm, but yeah, that one. Khabib Nurmagomedov versus Edson Barboza. Come on, son. Number two and number three in the lightweight division, which is the most stacked division, I think. It's like lightweight and welterweight are the two most stacked divisions. But it's hard to pick which one is most stacked. But Jesus Christ, I like this fight. I like this fight a lot. And apparently Nurmagomedov has a new, according to Daniel Cormier, he told me Nurmagomedov has a new conditioning guy and a new nutrition guy. And
less dessert.
No tiramisu. He's backing off the tiramisu. He's got him, you know, on a very strict diet plan, and he's far lighter than he's ever been. And we're headed into this fight. Great. This fight is in, what, 2 weeks now? The 30th. And
so
today is
3 weeks away.
3 weeks away. Yeah. So, very exciting. Very interesting. I'm fucking pumped for that fight because Barboza is one of the best strikers in the division, for sure. And Khabib can't do anything wrong on the feet because Edson can light him up, for sure. I mean, this is the best striker, for sure the best striker that Khabib has fought. He fought Michael Johnson, who's a good striker. And Michael Johnson caught him and tagged him and had him rocked. And it was the first time we saw any adversity whatsoever or any real struggle for Khabib. But he went on to dominate that fight, and he took him to the ground and just beat the shit out of him. And he's 24-0, which is unprecedented. You know, 24-0 and just been steamrolling everybody.
Mm. So, he's only like 30, right? 29, 30, something like that.
I do not know his age, but
anyways, he's.
I feel like he's not even in his prime yet. What does it say here? 29. Yeah. I mean, he's like right at the door of his athletic prime.
If he can stay healthy,
prime.
I know he's had a bunch of injuries, but if he can get healthy and stay healthy, man, it's gonna be scary seeing what he does.
Yeah, for Barboza, it's all about just keeping the fight standing. And Barboza has wicked leg kicks. He's the only guy in the UFC that stopped two guys with leg kicks. He stopped Rafael Oliveira with leg kicks and Mike Lulo. Both those guys he stopped with leg kicks. How do I remember that? I don't know. But his leg kicks are amongst the fastest I've ever seen in any division. His switch kick, fastest switch kick I've ever seen. It's fucking ridiculous. When he lights it up, like off that left leg, you're like, Jesus. Like, it's like he's getting there with half the time that most world-class fighters get there with that kick. So that's interesting.
Yeah, that spinning heel kick is
ridiculous.
As fast as most people's just normal head kick.
Yeah, his spinning shit's out of control. He's just a ridiculous striker. But it's all about Nurmagomedov getting him to the ground. The question is, he's going to be able to stuff the takedown? What's the strategy they have for this guy on the feet? Are they going to have him open up and possibly give up that takedown, or are they going to have him cautious and just throwing punches and just constantly wary about the takedown defense? Because Nurmagomedov has been unchallenged when it comes to the grappling. Mm-hmm. He's so goddamn strong. It's crazy.
He's dominant.
Well, even guys like Dos Anjos, who's a black belt in jiu-jitsu, usually puts the smush on people.
Right.
You know, Nurmagomedov puts the smush on him. He gets the guys to break, too. Like, you see it in their face. They're like, fuck, I can't do anything against this guy.
Yeah, he grew up doing it to bears, so that's why.
Yeah, for real, like legitimately. Yeah, no. Yeah.
My wife didn't believe that, so I had to pull it up and show her. And she's like, what are they doing to him?
Yeah. Like, why? That's a baby. Why did they make that baby fight a bear?
He was like 6, 7, 8 years old, and a bear's just biting him in the arm.
Yeah, Jimmy Rivera versus John Lineker. That's a fucking great fight, too. That's up in the right-hand corner there. Woo-wee.
Ooh, that's gonna be good.
That's a good fight. That's a real good fight. Jimmy Rivera has looked insanely good at 135, especially that victory over Uriah Faber. I was super impressed with that. I was like, wow, like this guy is for real. I knew it was for real before, but Rivera was supposed to be fighting Dominic Cruz, but Dominic Cruz broke his arm in training, and so now he's fighting John Lineker, who's a scary fucking guy at 135.
Yeah, I like this a lot for Jimmy because you can just hear every interview he does, he's just hungry, hungry for the chance to be world champ.
Yeah.
So it's exciting to see this fight happening.
I like it too. And there's interesting, TJ Dillashaw just shut John Lineker down. Mm-hmm. I mean, completely shut down his offense. And almost was like having
beautiful.
Beautiful. Beautiful. I mean, it was a perfect example of how you play the matador, like a technical matador. I mean, that was like one of his finest performances because Lineker is fucking terrifying. Like, everybody's in a war with Lineker. You know, like Ian McCall, like everybody who fights Lineker winds up being in these goddamn war. So many guys, they get in there with him and they get hit by him and you just see it on their face. Like, Jesus Christ.
He's one of the few guys that actually earned that nickname.
Yeah.
Hands of Stone.
Yeah, Francisco Rivera. Yeah. Like, so many guys he's fought. He cracks them and you just see the look in their eyes. They're like, oh, Christ. So he beat. He beat Marlon Vera, which is a very good fight. The TJ Dillashaw loss, I think, was the most telling because TJ Dillashaw figured out a way how to solve that puzzle when John Dodson couldn't, which was really interesting. John Dodson lost to Lineker when Dodson was thought to be one of the best guys in the division at 135, and he lost to him with a split decision. You know, he fucked up Michael McDonald in the fight before that. And he's just something special, man. You know, he really is. He's a tank of a guy. But I really honestly believe that Jimmy Rivera is world class, and I think this is a good opportunity for him to fight against a big, scary tank of a guy in John Lineker, and show his talent and his ability. I think it's a real test. I'm really interested to see how this works out. Because Rivera's not like an elusive TJ Dillashaw type guy. He's an attacker. So how is he going to, you know, what is he going to do with Lineker? Is he going to chop the legs? He's going to attack from below like he did with Uriah. Like, he fucked Uriah's leg up real early in that fight to the point where it really limited Uriah's mobility. That's an interesting fight. I like that fight a lot. Carlos Condit returns.
Yeah, against Magny.
Dun, dun, dun. That's interesting too. Carlos has been out for quite a long time. I want to say 2 years.
Yeah.
Click on his thing. Let's find out when his last fight was. I want to say it was about 2 years ago.
Didn't he?
He lost to Damian Maia.
And say that he was talking about retirement, or he was retiring then?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. August 2016. So not quite that long ago. And then before that, he lost the Robbie Lawler fight, which was a crazy 5-round war, and he lost a split decision.
Beat Tiago and lost to Tyron. So, I mean, those.
The victory over Tiago was phenomenal. He caught him with that elbow.
Yeah. That's murderer's row of his last opponents, man.
Yeah, and the Tyron Woodley loss was by injury. It says KO, TKO, but the reality is Tyron hit him with a brutal leg kick, and his knee blew out.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah. Apparently he had heard it before, but the power that Tyron Woodley has in his fucking leg kicks, like, Christ. Tyron Woodley had some choice words about Colby Covington, too. Yeah, he was, talking about Colby, like, campaigning hard to get the fight and talking all kinds of crazy shit about him. But Tyron was saying, like, this, first of all, everything he's saying about our training sessions is 100% bullshit. And he's like, when I get that dude in the octagon, if he ever does get that shot, he goes, I'm going to fuck him up. And I see Colby Covington is never going to fight again after he faces me. That's what he said. Yeah, we were talking before the weigh-ins. We were standing around the octagon before the weigh-ins this past UFC in Detroit. And he was like shaking his head. He's like, I am going to fuck that dude up. He's like, he does not understand. He's not on my level. He's talking all kinds of shit. He's, you know, writing all these checks that there's no way his fucking talent can cash. And when I get him in there, I'm going to smash him. And he goes, I'm going to take my time on him. I'm going to try to hurt him. This is what he said to me that was crazy. He goes, I have never tried to hit anyone with all my power in the octagon. And I'm like, wait, what?
Why not?
How's that possible? He sends people flying across the octagon. Watch his fight with Jay Heron.
You can
hit somebody harder than that. Are you sure? Because that doesn't seem normal. That doesn't seem right.
Talking about his leg kicks, I was just going to ask you, what did you think of being there for the Gaethje-Alvarez fight?
Jesus, that was great.
Gosh.
It was amazing. There was two fights that night that were humbling. That was one of them. That fight was humbling. Like the fucking guts and glory watching those guys go at it. But Yancy Medeiros and Cowboy Oliveira might have been even crazier. I think that was the craziest fight of the night. And I believe that one performance of the night. Thank the baby Jesus. Because if it didn't, there was some criminal shenanigans afoot. It was the craziest fight ever. One would get rocked, and then the other would get rocked. And you'd think the fight was over. And then the other one would come back and rock the other one. And then finally Yancy won in the third round. I mean, it was just a fucking chaotic war. It was such a good fight. Just such a good fight. Two bonuses. Two Fight of the Night awards. That's nice. See, that's what I love about the UFC. When people really perform and lay it on the line like that. But Did Aldo and Holloway win any sort of a fight of the night?
I know Francis didn't, but they said they were going
to hook him up with some sort of a bonus.
Yeah.
How do you not give that guy KO of the night? What are we doing here? What is it? What's that?
It just says that those two got fight of the night. It didn't say anything about anything else.
Oh, okay. So it says that fight get fight of the night?
No. The Gaethje.
Gaethje and Cowboy Oliveira, right, Yancy Medeiros got fight of the night. Well, Max Holloway's performance was nothing short of masterful. Nothing short of masterful. The way he handled Aldo, the way he yelled at me after the first round. He gets done with the round and he's going back to his, and he looks at me and goes, "The man is tired. The man is tired." He's a motherfucker. Dude, Max Holloway is a real fucking warrior. I mean, to the core. That guy relishes it. He loves it. When he was like chicken necking at Aldo, and he's got his hands down, he's talking shit to him and stalking him, you could see it in Aldo's face like he was drowning. You could see the waves were coming, and he knew he wasn't going to be able to dog paddle for too long. Like, he's like, Jesus Christ, like, how am I going to keep up with this guy? And the thing about Max Holloway that's so interesting is he's in a lot of ways, he has that sort of Nick Diaz approach where he's not hitting you with all of his might. He's not throwing these haymakers unless he's got you hurt. Until he's got you hurt. Once he's got you hurt, then he's just fucking whipping bombs your way. But until then, he's just constantly on you, just constantly peppering you, constantly on you. Kick, knee, punch, move forward. And you're just dealing with him and trying to breathe. You don't get any breath. And he just keeps that pressure on you. And he knew Aldo was fading right now. And I'll tell you, Aldo looked good in that first round.
Yeah, I thought he was going to start picking it up like almost the Aldo of old with the leg kicks.
He should have.
Just leg kick.
He should have gone. His strategy should have been almost entirely leg kick centered.
Right.
And he was trying to catch him, and he caught him with a couple of good punches. But all of his punches are sprints, right? And if he doesn't knock you out with those sprints, like, he only has so many of those in the gas tank.
You're fighting the guy that can do it for a marathon. So.
And he can. And Max Holloway can. He is so well conditioned and so aware of his ability and not stretching himself. So when they got to the third, he started slugging it out with Aldo at the very beginning of the third. He's like, I know this guy's tired. He goes, I'm going to make him sprint with me. And you could see, like, as the beginning of the third round played out, Aldo was swinging wild at him. And I was watching this. I was like, this is not conservative. Like, he's not conserving his energy at all. What he's doing is trying to take Max Holloway out with one shot, and he's blowing out his entire wad doing this. And then you saw Holloway just coming on, just bang, 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 pop, 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 pop. And Aldo's trying to move his head, and he's using all his head movement, but he never gets a break.
Yeah, it's an incredible pace that Holloway has. Incredible.
He doesn't give you any space. You don't get any rest. You don't get. There's no laying back with Holloway. Max Holloway's on you, on you, on you. I love what he said about fighting Aldo in Rio, too. He goes, that's what kings do. He goes, they go to the other person's village and they take their crown. I was like, ooh. That's right. That's what they do. That's what he did. He's the baddest motherfucker. I think he's the best 145er ever. I mean, he might not agree with it yet because of the record, which I see his point, but the way he fights, the octagon IQ that he shows, his fight IQ, his ability to find a weakness and to see it, his predatory behavior inside the octagon, I think he's the best. I really do. I just think I it's so impressive to me that he's not like Aldo in his prime was spectacular and amazingly impressive. Like his flying knee, first round knockout of Cub Swanson, the knockout of Chad Mendez. You know, I mean, he's the Uriah Faber fight where he brutalized Uriah's leg. I mean, he's unquestionably one of the greats of all time. But in my opinion, skill-wise, Max Holloway has now surpassed him. I think he's the best.
Yeah. What are your takes? Who do you have for the Bellator heavyweight tournament?
I'm fucking very curious about that. First of all, I thought it was really interesting they decided to go with Mitrione versus Roy Nelson right out of the gate.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting because, first of all, Mitrione just knocked out Fedor, mm-hmm. right? Wouldn't you, like, want to see that again? Like, does Fedor want to see that again? Because Mitrione's fighting Frank Mir. I do not know what kind of testing that Bellator is employing, but I hope it's Wild West style testing. I hope they pee in a cup, hold it up to the light, and if nothing's swimming in it, they go, you're good. Let them roll.
Yeah, I'm kind of campaigning right now to be the alternate. So I would love to be the alternate in the tournament.
What is your ranking in the Bellator heavyweight division right now? Do they have one?
I'm not sure that they really have an official one. So, but I'm, you know, I think if I'm not in there for this as the alternate, I think that I'll be one of the first title defenses.
Interesting.
That's what I'll be hoping for. And I'll stay active. I'm going to fight. Hopefully I'll pick it up to two, three fights a year.
And King Mo is in the heavyweight tournament with Ryan Bader, who's the light heavyweight champion.
That's going to happen in May. It's Chael versus Rampage in January. Then it's the Roy Nelson and Matt Mitrione in February. And then they have the Fedor versus Frank Mir in April. So they're going to take a break in March.
The only thing I don't like about this is it locks everybody up for a long-ass time. Like, I would like it if that was all on, like, two shows.
Yeah.
Or maybe even one crazy card. You know, have all the fights on one card.
Yeah, I think Mir has to wait till April. So
why is that? For his contract?
I think it's the testing that he had in the UFC. And then
Don't test him, Bellator. Don't do it.
And so I think he's suspended until April, and then and then he can fight. And so, but that fight, I think probably a lot of fans 10 years ago, but now too, are going to be really excited to see Mir versus Fedor, you know, two kind of legendary champions.
Oh, yeah, man.
And then I don't know why the Bader one and King Mo one's all the way back in May. But
well,
I
King
think
Mo's had some pretty significant injuries that he's had to deal with.
Okay. And Bader just fought recently, so maybe he needed some time too.
Yeah.
But yeah, maybe it's the injuries with Mo. But man, I'm excited. So I'm just training and ready to jump in. I'm actually getting to go climb Mount Kilimanjaro maybe. I'm deciding on it this next week to see if I can cement the alternate position or not.
To me, the big one is Rory McDonald, Douglas Lima.
Mm.
That's the big one.
Yeah.
That's the big
January.
One. That's the big one.
That's going to be big.
That's the one where I'm like, okay. Because I feel like when it comes to the welterweight division, Bellator has two guys in Lima and in see, the Lima thing, the only thing that stands out in the Lima thing is Ben Askren. It was Ben Askren, and it was a long time ago, no doubt about it. But Ben Askren just had his way with Lima and had his way with Koroshkov, had his way with all these guys. That, to me, and Ben's coming on the podcast next month. We got him scheduled.
Awesome.
Before or after, I forget which one, the event out here, the Bellator event. But I feel like that is, I mean, now that he's retired, that is my biggest regret. That he didn't get in MMA, that he didn't get into the UFC. Yeah. My biggest regret.
Yeah, I wish they could have worked that out, whatever it was.
Fuck. I wanted to see what would happen.
Yeah.
You want to see what happens with him and Tyron Woodley. You want to see what happens with him and world-class wrestlers who are also knockout artists. You want to see what happens with him and the elite of the elite at 170 in the octagon. And for whatever reason, and I'm sure he'll tell us, and I'm sure he'll be very, very outspoken.
Yeah. I wonder if it's the whole style thing. I mean, like the hardcore fans. Yeah, yeah. Hardcore fans love it. But then it's almost like, I won't use his name, but I know a fighter that fought in the upper weight classes in the UFC, you know, 9 or 10 wins and only 2 losses and gets cut. And so it's almost like, you know, you gotta be
in. Who's that?
Jared Rochalt.
Oh, so, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, great guy, awesome training partner, great fighter.
And he had fights. Why did he get cut?
It was after he had an early loss in the UFC, and then he went on a tear, mm-hmm. and then he had another loss, and they cut him.
One loss.
Yeah.
That seems crazy.
So I think he had like 8, 9, or 10 wins and only 2 losses there. And then so it was after one loss and he was gone. So I believe it was because of the style.
The style.
But he's a great guy.
Yeah, man. That style's legitimate, though. The problem is you can't decide that you need things to be exciting. You need things. Your sport is things being effective. Mm. The whole idea is, like, here you go. You got a guy like Francis Ngannou who can knock anybody's head into another dimension, right? Well, what happens if Francis Ngannou gets smothered by some Rulon Gardner type character?
Yeah, Rochalt.
Yeah, some giant dude who grabs a hold of him, drags him to the ground, and fucking hammer fists him for 3-5 rounds. You know, like, you don't you want to see that? I want to see that.
Yeah.
I want to know that this kind of guy can be immobilized,
right?
That he can be neutralized, and we've seen Ben Askren do that.
Yeah,
to really, like, Koreshkov and Lima, two fucking straight up assassins, right?
Right.
We've seen him do that. So I wanted to see him try to fight like some of the elite, because I think that style is critical. The wrestling style is the hardest style to deal with if you can't compete with the wrestler. That's why I've always said, if you had like a pyramid of all the techniques in martial arts, like, what would be the most important? I think wrestling, because the ability to dictate where the fight takes place. And by wrestling, I include takedown defense, which is obviously a wrestling skill. But wrestling, the ability to dictate where the fight takes place is fucking critical. And if you could take the guy down, having the ability to take a guy down is giant. You're on top of him. You're smothering him. He's got to carry your weight. It's exhausting. You're beating him up while he's down there. Mm-hmm. It's a giant factor. You know, obviously every fight starts standing up. But when a good striker is fighting a good wrestler, they're fucking always worry to let anything go.
Right.
As soon as they tee off on something, woo, the double's on them, and then they're on their ass. So I think that a guy who has been proven to be one of the most difficult wrestlers to deal with, to not have him fight in the octagon is a tragedy. Hmm. It's a fucking real bummer, man.
Yeah, it is.
And I wonder how many wrestlers out there are looking at Ngannou and going, I wonder what would happen if you take that guy down.
Yeah, no, I mean, even me being in the same weight class, I mean, that's my wife was asking, who would you be more terrified to fight before the fight, you mm-hmm. know, with
how
Alistair?
How much do you weigh right
262.
Now? We can get you down 205. Get you going keto.
Yeah, but when Overeem and him were facing off, she's like, which one would you prefer to fight? And I was like, I think Ngannou. I think Francis.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. Well, this was before he sent Alistair into orbit. But because you take him down.
Right.
Take him down, and then it's your game, hopefully. And
he's apparently
with Alistair, he's so seasoned and everything else,
right.
And he does have some takedown defense, and he does have some submissions. So I've just seen him be more well-rounded,
mm-hmm.
But that was before,
right?
This
obviously,
outcome.
Before,
yeah, obviously.
Yeah, I would have talked to you before that, and I would have said no, no, because my thought before the fight when I talked to Shab and I were talking on the phone. He said, "What do you think's going to happen?" I think Alistair doesn't make it out of the first round. I think we went over all the times Alistair's been stopped.
That's a big factor.
It was a big factor.
Yeah. Isn't it more than 10 times?
Yes. More than 10 times in MMA. I think it was, what was it, like 12 times in 13. MMA? 13 times in MMA, and then 3 or 4 times in kickboxing as well.
What's that analogy? Is there any truth to it? It's almost like a peanut butter jar or something. The first time you open it, you got to get out a towel and put over it and try really hard to open that lid. And then after that, it's a little easier. And then it's a little easier until eventually you do it enough and you can just spin it off, just flick it, you know?
Yeah. Well, and he's in the flick it stage.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter. That punch would have knocked him out when he was 20.
Oh, yeah. That wouldn't have knocked anyone out.
Yeah. I mean,
any human being.
That punch was insane.
Mark Contour, Roy Nelson, either of those guys.
And so, the way he threw it, it was like a leg, like from the thigh, and then whipping that arm with the whole body behind it, just full torque.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it had everything. It had all the power.
I was a little skeptical of the, well, it was probably from listening to Brendan, but talk about the punching power. You know, well, who else? Has Mark Hunt hit it and has Crow Cop kicked it and everything else? And then all of a sudden, once you see that punch, you're like, he's sealed the deal.
Dude, I've shook homeboy's hand and it's like holding hands with a fucking cinder block. Let's see that again. Boom. See how he like comes up from the thigh and the arm whips up? Look at this. Wham!
Oh, man.
Oh my goodness. And as he's punching, he's moving in position to punch a second time. Then he hammer fists him while he's out. Boom.
Thank goodness he got in there.
He certainly, the referee got in as quick as he could, but he certainly could have not hit him while he was down. He was out cold. What are you going to say?
Who got knocked out with a bunch of the elbows? Didn't there like 7-8 extra elbows at the end before the ref stepped in?
In this past weekend?
Yeah, yeah. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
I'm going to say Gary Goodridge.
They weren't like extra elbows, but like it was like, man, you probably should have stopped that early.
Pull up the card. I'm trying to remember. Sorry. Try to figure out who it was.
Paul Felder?
Yes, yeah, Felder beat the shit out of him. Yeah, that was an interesting fight because what played out is exactly what I thought. It was like Oliveira is really dangerous with his grappling. His grappling is phenomenal. He has submitted, I think he's tied with Royce Gracie for submitting the most guys in the UFC, which is, how badass is Royce Gracie? All these years
all these
later,
years he has
still
the
got the record.
That's awesome.
You know, pretty goddamn significant.
Yeah.
But he smashed him with that one shot, and then
he
tapped.
He's got such great elbows, man.
Yeah, he tapped.
That's right. That's what happened. No one saw the tap.
Yeah. And Felder just smashed him. Well, Felder's an enormous 55. Felder walks around somewhere in the 185-pound range, and then Jiat's down to 55. Yeah, he tapped, but the referee didn't see it.
1, 2, 3.
And, you know, he can't let him up.
5. Oof.
Yeah.
6. Yikes. Should have tapped a little harder than that.
Yeah, you got to let. Don't. I mean, that's like a humble tap. Like,
you got it.
You got to tap. Like, okay, we're done here. Yeah, you can't tap.
Paul didn't even realize he tapped.
You
know?
Can't be reluctant. You can't have a reluctant tap. It's got to be like, but guys don't want to tap. You know, like, I'm kind of tapping.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've seen fights
like
where
Joanna, right?
Guys said they tapped, but they didn't. Yeah, the Joanna thing, she still says she didn't tap.
Yeah.
But she definitely did.
Mm-hmm.
She probably doesn't realize she tapped because she was in dreamland. You know, I mean, she got hit so hard and got dropped. But guys have tapped. Said they didn't tap. Remember Marilla Bustamante and Matt Lindland?
Yep, that's what I was going to say.
They restarted the fight. Matt Lindland got caught in an armbar, clearly tapped.
Yep.
And Big John McCarthy separated them, was declaring Bustamante the winner. Lindland said, I didn't tap. I was moving around. I wasn't tap. Okay. And then Bustamante, you can tell he's like, what in the fuck? Are you serious? And then they make him go back at it again, and then he catches him in a guillotine the next round.
Yeah, I mean, I started in 2005 or 6 fighting, and I remember a lot of wrestlers talking about wrestler tricks as if you go for the double leg and you start getting a takedown, you know, tap.
Here it is. Watch. I don't know. Hold on. Let me watch that again. Play it right there. Yeah, that looks like he's tapping. But then he says he's not. It seems like he wanted to tap, but he didn't. Let me see it again. I'm less convinced now. Watch this again. Here it is. He's got the arm. Turns him over. Yeah, that's a tap.
Yeah.
That's a fucking tap. Yeah. And then he said he didn't.
I know a lot of wrestlers would talk about if, you know, you get in a guillotine, try to see where the ref is, and then you can tap on the other side.
Do you remember Chael did that?
Oh, yeah.
Chael did that with Paulo Filho in WEC.
Yeah, that's right.
And then they fought again. The second time they
fought,
two-team
quest guys.
Filho didn't make weight, and now he catches him with the guillotine. This is it right here. Old school Carlson Gracie style, son. Yeah, I mean, Bustamante was a wizard back then. A lot of people forgot how good he was. At the top of his game, man, he was one of the that's a tap right there. He was one of the fucking best. Such a good jiu-jitsu guy and really good boxing too. But Paulo Filho went crazy. Remember, he was kind of like the second time they fought, he missed weight. So Sonnen should rightly, by all accounts, really be he should have been the WEC 185-pound champion. But he never he never got that title because Philo didn't make the weight, and then they had some real weird fight where, like, Philo was saying, just do my friend, come to the ground with me. He's like, can't do that, sorry. And he said he was talking to him. Like, you know, remember when Paulo had, like, a kind of a bit of a breakdown, right?
Yeah.
Got a Mike Tyson tattoo on his face and was acting real weird.
Just disappeared.
Yeah.
Man, he was a beast. Guys,
he was
a monster.
At one point in time, yeah, he was submitting everybody. He was so good. And he submitted a bunch of people, at least one or two people in Pride, I believe. But yeah, he was another guy. He was a Carlson Gracie guy as well, right?
I believe so.
Yeah, world-class jiu-jitsu guy who's just a little pit bull of a man. Yeah.
Yeah, like the pre-Paul Harris.
What do you think about what Ryzen is doing now? You know, Ryzen is trying to kind of bring back the Pride days.
I miss the Pride days.
Me so too. I miss them,
a lot. So I support it.
Yeah.
I hope they do it well.
They're doing a lot of freak shows too. Like they had, wasn't Ryzen Gabby Garcia versus some maid?
The old lady.
Yeah.
The grandma.
Well, she's had a couple.
Yeah, there's
one.
She literally fought a grandma. Like not just joking around, like she was a grandmother. And so,
a grandma with a bad knee, remember?
Yeah.
Grandma
and she
had
didn't
a knee
want to be in
on.
There. You could see, like, once it started, it was like they put her up to that.
Why would they put her up to that?
I have no clue. Maybe they can't find anyone to fight Gabby.
I'm sure they can't.
Yeah, but it's almost like I'd rather not see that fight happen, though.
For people who don't know, Gabby Garcia is probably 225 pounds and jacked.
Yeah.
She
would be my training partner.
Yes. Like, legitimately.
Legitimately, yeah. I'm 6'3", 262. She'd be my training partner.
Yeah. Crazy. Yeah. She'd be, I think she's taller than you.
Oh, she probably is.
She's a gorilla. So big. So finding a female competitor to compete with her. Good luck.
Yeah. Well, whenever they were always talking about the Rousey could beat guys in her division and different stuff like that, you would almost think they have to have no other options to where Gabby's going to have to fight a guy someday.
I know, right?
Maybe like a 185 or something like
right.
that. But yeah.
Yeah, look at the size of her.
Oh, my goodness.
It's so insane. And this is her versus a little girl in kickboxing. This is a kickboxing fight. Oh, my God. She's so... Oh, I see.
MMA.
It's MMA. What are those gloves?
Maybe the smaller one didn't want to fight her in MMA gloves because it should take too much of a beating.
They do look like boxing gloves, don't they?
Yeah.
I think this is a kickboxing fight. I think that's why they stopped the fight after that takedown attempt.
Okay.
Right? Because they got back up to their feet. This is a kickboxing fight.
Maybe it's an
fight.
MMA fighter, though, doing it. Ooh.
Yeah. She's getting battered. She's getting hit by tree trunks.
But,
this is so crazy.
When she fought Grandma, that was I was sad for the woman that had to go out there.
This is in Brazil versus Megumi Yabushita. Japan, brutal knockout, illegal soccer kick. Okay, I don't want to watch this. Here it is.
Oof.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Illegal soccer kick. That's a good night. Yeah, when you're 100 pounds bigger than someone, please don't soccer kick them when they're down illegally. That just seems like...
logical.
Adding insult to injury. So what else is coming up next that you're excited about? Is Paul Daly fighting Semtex? Semtex fighting Michael Venom Page?
That they want to. I know that Semtex is going after that, but I don't think it's finalized.
Is Michael Page into the fight? Does he want to have that fight?
I think he's a little more on the fence about it.
Really?
I think Daly is like campaigning for it, at least the last I heard.
I love shit talking with a British accent.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite things. Yeah.
Anything with a British accent.
Especially from Daly, you know, like you look at him, this muscular animal. He's such a fucking psycho.
Dude.
And just what a fucking left hand that guy's got.
Gosh.
When he stopped Lorenz Larkin, I was like, whoa, that's for real.
Yeah. That'll be really exciting to see if it happens.
Yeah.
Because even Venom Page with that flying knee.
Oh, with the cyborg one?
The face, yeah.
Jesus Christ. I've never seen anything like that in my life.
Yeah. I think it's the right fight to do, so hopefully Venom Page is... And I don't think he's... I don't know. Maybe it's other details they need to work out to make it happen, but it seems like Daly's the one that's been campaigning for it, and Michael Venom Page hasn't yet, so...
Yeah, because after Rory McDonald beat Daly, Daly was immediately saying he wanted to fight Page.
Right.
It wasn't like saying, like, I didn't really want to fight Rory, fuck this fight. He's, like, immediately going after that. He didn't want to rematch with Rory. He was just... Michael Venom Page and him have some serious bad blood.
Yeah.
Makes it exciting.
Really exciting, man.
Yeah.
I don't know. Here we go.
After boxing debut win, who's Paul Daly?
Oh, yeah, that's what
he's
doing.
Right. He had a boxing match. Who's Paul Daly? That's funny. Who the fuck is that guy?
which is probably one of the most brilliant lines. Now everyone else can copy.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
The timing of that when Jeremy Stevens yelled that out. Yeah, Venom Page looked amazing in his boxing match. Mm. It's like you're hearing all this shit now about Conor possibly fighting Paulie Malignaggi.
And then Pacquiao, fight? Right?
Huh?
In an MMA fight?
No, boxing? Okay. Boxing match in a cage. That was the latest. Like a boxing match in the octagon. Listen, the WME crew, the people who own the UFC now, I think they're willing to put on whatever fight's going to bring in the most shekels. You know, that's what they got to do now. But now they got a star. I think Ngannou, one or two more fights, you're going to be looking at Mike Tyson days. That's what I think. I think Ngannou is going to be like, you're going to watch fights just to see how long these motherfuckers can survive against that guy. That's what I think. And I think that could be their big breakout star. Conor, who knows if he's ever going to fight again. I mean, we really don't know. We haven't heard Conor saying, you know, this is my plan. This is who I'm thinking about fighting. This is who I want to fight. He's been talking shit to Max Holloway. Mm. He's been talking shit to Tony Ferguson. But he's not said, like, set it up. So,
did you know what Francis was really talking about whenever he was talking about the slaves?
Yes.
That was happening?
Yes. Man,
that's so nuts.
Yeah, we played that on the podcast. We showed a lot of that stuff that's going on in Libya. They had open slave auctions, and people filmed it and put it on YouTube in 2017.
Yeah. I know multiple people from Uganda, Rwanda, and Congo that were they were lured into some of these countries like there, and they would go there thinking that they were going to have a job opportunity and that they would be working at this place or that place or whatever. And you start here and you work your way up, but automatically you're going to be making more than you've ever made in a year every week. And so they go there thinking that they're going to be able to have a new job, send back a bunch of money to their family. Then all of a sudden they get there, they take all their documents away from them to where they can't travel, they can't escape. If they do, they don't speak the language. And then they throw them into someone's house and they're literally their slave. And they were lured there. Now all of a sudden you're a slave.
And how long are they keeping them there for?
They'll keep them there forever. But then some of these families that are able to, some of these people that are able to make contact with their families, they have to fundraise and come up with thousands and thousands of dollars. I'm talking like an African family that might make $1 to $1.25 per day is now having to come up with $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $10,000,
to try to buy them back,
to try to buy them back out of it. So,
do you know there's more slavery today than any other time
ever
recorded
in human history? Yeah. So yeah. The lowest statistic is 27 million, but I think it's over 30 million.
Just stop and think about it. Most people in America, if you talk to them about slavery, they're like, oh, well, yeah, that ended in 1865.
Nope.
Not only did it not end, there's more today than ever. Mm. But until we saw the Libya, the YouTube video where you see the one guy saying he can lift heavy things, he's a good digger, and you're like, what? Yeah. And they were selling him for like $400, $600.
Yeah, so the Mobutu Pygmies, actually. So this is what the documentary is really covering. I cover a little bit of it in the book, but we've actually seen 1,500 people, and that's what, at the Comedy Store tonight, we'll play the short trailer for it, and it's going to talk about the slavery that's in there. There's 400,000 to 600,000 Mobutu Pygmies in the Congo, and basically all of them are enslaved currently, right now. And so we've actually seen peaceful negotiations of 1,500 people transition out of a life of slavery and into a life of freedom. And we're hoping that we can replicate that. And so how we're able to do it is we're able to work with the local, state, and national government on documents. And then also we're able to buy back the land from the slave master. So they benefit financially by having maybe more money than they've ever made from their slaves. We get water for both sides. So the slave masters, it's a different context for slavery. There's a lot of places like Libya or different countries that they're really rich and they have a bunch of slaves. But in this context, it's a family owns a family in most cases. Some own many families. I've attended the funerals of the slave master's kids. The slave master's kids are dying of dirty water because they have zero access to it. Wow. And so whenever you can bring in, because they're making $1, $1.25 a day on the film, there's going to be a beautiful part on the documentary. I don't want to ruin that part or Cillian of the Thunder, but it's, man, there's a slave master crying on camera with us, crying, because of how much of a benefit it's been, the peace that's come from not having the slaves that he inherited from his father, who inherited them from his grandfather, because it became a burden where they're making $1.25 a day. They're spending on average, the average person in Congo spending $185 a year on treatment against waterborne disease. So on medicine and all this stuff, they're spending half of their salary on waterborne disease. They're losing their kids because of it. And now they're making $1.25 a day trying to take care of their own family. How are they supposed to take care of their slave family? And so they can give them just the scraps. And so whenever we get to come in there and say, hey, this land is rightfully the Mobutu Pygmies. They're the first citizens of Congo. They're the first people here. They're the native Congolese. They don't you think they deserve some land? And so we kind of cast a vision, work together with them. It's all inclusive to where they get to share their concerns and questions, and they get to be part of it and say, we want this here. And so then all of a sudden, once that happens, we do the land purchases. It's all legal. And then we bring in water for both sides to where they both have clean water access to that, which changes everything. Whenever the slave master's wife is on average going 3.75 miles to go collect water, she can't do other things.
Imagine that you own slaves and you have to walk 3 miles to get water.
To go get water. And or you're a slave master, and if you are fortunate enough that your wife doesn't have to go collect water all day, one of your kids can't go to school because they have to go collect water all day. And so, and when those jerry cans are full, 20 liters is 44 pounds when full. And a lot of times you do it with two, because if you're not going to carry it on your head, and if you're going to make the most of your time, that 3.75 mile walk, you're going to go with two jerry cans on that walk, and then it'll balance you out almost like kettlebells. Yeah. And so you get two 44 pound, almost kettlebells, but jerry cans of water that's moving, that's so hard to carry, and you walk that back.
100 pounds. You're basically walking back with 100 pounds.
Yeah. Yeah, 88 pounds. And so to be able to alleviate.
You're a tiny person. You're not a big person.
Yeah,
anyway.
Some of them are girls that are, you know, teenagers and stuff. And
imagine trying to get an American teenager to carry 88 pounds.
Man, it hurts me going on it. Like, literally, I go on those. Our team normally does the water walk in every new village that we go to. So probably 70 water walks now. There might be one or two that we didn't do. But the first 13 we did when I was there. And man, it's to understand, to put yourself literally in their shoes and go on that long walk and to have the sore neck from carrying it on your head, or to have just your shoulders dying because you're walking back with 88 pounds. You're not doing, I mean, think about whenever we're doing those kettlebell walks.
I know, I mean,
how many feet are we going? But go miles that way.
Yeah, I put on one of those outdoorsman's vests. You know what those things are? The outdoorsman's pack that has a weight plate in the back, one of those posts for weight plates. And I slide on a 45-pound plate and I hike the mountains with it. Just 45 pounds.
Yeah.
You go like, that's not, I weigh 200 pounds. Why would 45 pounds be a lot? It's a fucking lot, man. It's a lot. So to think that these women are carrying double that and they're walking through the jungle.
Yeah.
It's fucking.
Oh, man. It's not funny, but I mean, they cracked up because they're so used to carrying this walk. But I'm going down this steep hill, and it's on a little foot trail, and it's muddy because it had been raining. And so I'm having this thing on my head, and I fall on my back, and the water just soaks me because all the water that we went and collected, half of it ended up on me and on the ground.
Did you go back and get more water?
No.
Wow.
No, because we were currently trying to drill the new well, and we were getting pretty close to it.
Damn.
And so, but just slipping, falling while you're doing it, losing your balance. I sprained my knee one time on one of the water walks because you're carrying all this weight. You step in a hole, and then all of a sudden you sprain your ankle, sprain your knee, different stuff like that.
Well, listen, Justin Wren, you are doing the Lord's work. You're doing amazing stuff, man. And I'm so happy that we can help, and I'm happy that we can help tonight. If you were thinking about coming to the show, you're shit out of luck.
Sold out.
It was sold out a long fucking time ago. So tonight will be Tom Segura, Tony Hinchcliffe, Whitney Cummings, Owen Smith, Tom Papa. Is that everybody? And me. Is that it? That's it. That's the show. Tonight, 9:30 at the Comedy Store, and all the proceeds will be donated to Fight for the Forgotten.
Woo-ah!
Woo-ah!
Ayo!
Right. Whatever he said.
Oh, yeah!
Thank you, brother. Appreciate you, man.
Thanks, brother.